here in Fordham at the age of 27. He was given the living here at Fordham because he'd written a defense of Calvinism entitled A Display of Arminianism. And he was married whilst here. And whilst here at Fordham, he wrote The Duty of Pastors and People Distinguished, as well as a catechism which he used to visit his parishioners. Now, as many of you will know, even with a passing interest in John Owen, he's considered to be one of the greatest English theologians. He was also chaplain to Oliver Cromwell through contact that he made with Fairfax when Colchester was being besieged just down the road. He preached to Parliament after the execution of Charles I and was Vice-Chancellor of Oxford University. And his achievements were even more incredible when we consider that he lived through the tumultuous times of the Civil War, and all 11 of his children predeceased him through illness. So his theology is not some dry, distant theology. It was tested in the crucible of suffering. For these reasons and many more, it's fitting that this barn that we're meeting in is named the John Owen Barn in his memory, and really to honour the theology which has so formed the ministry here over many years. And we're delighted to have Reverend Dr. Lee Gatiss here with us this evening, who's completed a PhD on John Owen, leading to a number of publications, one of which is here with us this evening, but more of that a little later on. We're in very good hands, so please would you welcome Lee Gatiss.
Thank you. It's a great privilege to be here in the barn and in the very parish where John Owen was a minister. Now, I'm very disappointed by your introduction because, as I'm sure you know, but you just didn't want to baffle us with too much science, John, the name of the book which got Owen this parish was not A Display of Arminianism. It has a Greek title.
Oh, sorry.
The subtitle is A Display of Arminianism. So I expect you to go home and do some research now so that you can tell us the actual Greek title of his book. And that's one of the things he often did. He gave his books either a Latin or a Greek title and an English subtitle. Just to bamboozle people with science. Now, he was vicar here. This was his first pastoral charge in 1643. In terms of his public influence, John Owen was a rising star in the 1640s and at the very height of his powers in the 1650s. Christopher Hill describes him as Cromwell's archbishop. And he may actually have lived for a time in the central London lodgings, which belongs to Archbishop William Laud, who, as you may remember, had his head chopped off so that Owen could live in his house. That's not quite the connection you should have drawn. I'm just being cheeky there. As chaplain to Oliver Cromwell, Dean of Christchurch, Oxford, and Vice-Chancellor of Oxford University, he was very comfortably provided for and wielded a significant degree of influence and power within the short-lived English Republic. We may add to this his potency as a parliamentary preacher and a prolific author during this period. Famously, John Owen was chosen as the preacher to the House of Commons the very day after Charles I had his head chopped off. As Nicholas Tyack asserts in his History of the University of Oxford, amidst a very distinguished Calvinist presence in Oxford during the 17th century, judged by the criteria of publication, Owen stands out at this period. Yet he eventually found himself on the losing side of the struggles of the 17th century and was ousted from his position of national preeminence. First, by his estrangement from Oliver Cromwell, especially after Cromwell considered accepting the crown. And second, by the recapture of that crown by Charles Stuart, Charles II, in 1660. After the Act of Uniformity of 1662 essentially barred Owen from any position in the established church, Owen's enemies mockingly referred to him as the Atlas of Independency, alongside lots of other even less flattering titles, the Moloch of Protectorship and that sort of thing. He lived for a while under the protection of the Earl of Oxford, and as one of the most influential leaders amongst the dissenters, his experience of this defeat that they suffered in 1662 may have been somewhat mitigated by his continuing prominence within that admittedly smaller circle. Yet despite his own survival personally, the vision for church and state that he represented had been vanquished by 1662. Scandalous reports later in the 1660s made out that Owen was part of a small group, an inner circle, that was close to the government itself. But those rumours were false. However, his old tutor from Queen's College, Oxford, Thomas Barlow, observed in January 1669 that Owen had kissed the king's hand, and there were rumours that either he or the other great Puritan leader at the time, Richard Baxter, would receive the next vacant bishopric. Could that happen? Well, I think that kind of rumour going around indicates Owen's continuing prominence in the 1660s, but, well, just like Baxter, I think that Owen, had he been offered a bishopric, would have refused it had anything come his way. Because Owen, you see, had long been an opponent of episcopacy, the form of governance in the Church of England being governed by bishops, not to mention his opposition to some of the ceremonies and canons, our laws, in the Church of England. In a very rare public comment, which ties together Owen's public and private lives, he reveals in a published work in 1657, "As I was bred up from my infancy under the care of my father, who was a nonconformist all his days and a painful labourer in the vineyard of the Lord," I think that means he was a painstaking labourer, not that he was painful to listen to when he was preaching, as many Puritans probably were. "My father was a painful labourer in the vineyard of the Lord, so ever since I came to have any distinct knowledge of the things belonging to the worship of God, I have been fixed in my judgment against episcopacy and ceremonies." Any Baptists or nonconformists amongst us tonight will have their hearts strangely warmed by this. Yes, there we are. Now, despite the fact that he could not, therefore, realistically expect any preferment or leadership within the national religious establishment, as Christopher Hill also says, post-Restoration survival was easier for Owen than for many nonconformists. He had rich and influential friends who were willing and able to house him, to protect him at various times, and he was even able to assemble and to gather together a congregation of noble worthies in Leadenhall Street in the city of London. His advice was sought by many in Old England and in New England, where his books sold particularly well, and he retained sufficient wealth and land to give himself a not uncomfortable living. At his death, his wealth was assessed as £1,332.10, a not insubstantial fee amount in those days, plus land in Oxfordshire and Berkshire. He certainly doesn't seem to have struggled financially in the way that poor old John Bunyan seems to have done, and alongside other dissenters. Other nonconformists in his circle were no doubt jealous of Owen on this score. His keeping of a horse and carriage in the 1670s, for example, caused quite a bit of hostile comment from other nonconformists. It must have been difficult for him at that point in his life, I think, moving from place to place as he had to several times in this period. It may also have been problematic for him as a scholar, accustomed, as he was, to having the trappings of university life all around him, to suddenly be without a well-stocked library or a concentration of intellectual peers. He just didn't have these things anymore. No port in the combination room after evening prayer for him. However, if the auction catalogue of his personal library sold off in 1684 is any indication, he did possess around 3,000 volumes, some quite specialised and useful for his scholarly work. Now, that's certainly comparable. If you look at other scholarly libraries at the time, it's comparable to those of others of a similar stature. But to put it in its context, the average clergyman at this point in the 17th century would have only had around a dozen books. I imagine the other clergymen here may have one or two more than that nowadays. But the average person would only had one or two books, and a clergyman might have had a dozen, but Owen had 3,000. So he wasn't without some learned help. He also had some secretarial assistants and some very learned people to help him with his writing and correspondence. Nevertheless, Owen's life was not easy after the Restoration. His income was reduced, and lands that he had previously owned in Ireland, for example, was transferred back to a different owner. In the early years of the persecution of the Puritans and the so-called Clarendon Code, his house was raided a number of times. On one occasion, this is interesting, on one occasion, the suspicious authorities who raided his house carried out with them 6 boxes of pistols. Now, that's quite a personal arsenal if it's just being kept for some sort of, you know, personal protection. Unless there are any friends here from Texas who probably think, this is really not enough. You should have had more than 6 boxes of pistols. On another occasion, Owen was seized in the street by informers, and he tells us he only managed to escape as a bird from the snare of the fowler. He continued to be watched by government informers, who even attended his church in order to hear him at close quarters. I wonder if there'll be any from MI5 tomorrow in church here listening to my sermon. Now, some of Owen's unpublished sermons from this time, which we still have in manuscripts in London, reveal and reflect his disturbance at the spectre of persecution that he and others were facing at that time. He considered leaving England for Massachusetts, having been offered a pastorate there and also the presidency of Harvard. There is evidence that he was involved in negotiations to buy land in New Hampshire in 1664, and he even went so far as to have all his belongings packed and taken to a boat in 1665 after the plague in London. But he didn't go. The Owens, as a family, had to send their children away to stay with friends for their own safety for long stretches of time, and we can see from their letters that this caused them severe heartache. Then when his first wife, Mary, died in 1676, only one of their 11 children was still alive at that point. And her unhappy marriage caused her to come home. She was then ill, and then she also died. So all 11 of his children predeceased him. Must have brought him considerable sorrow in his personal life. Alongside that, Owen suffered various ailments himself. He had some kind of eye disease, felt such infirmities of age in 1670 that he thought he was going apace towards my rest. He complains in one letter of a relapse into my flux with such violence that I felt I had the sentence of death in myself, and was troubled by kidney and liver complaints, of which he did finally die in 1683. He often spoke of his continued indisposition as to health, frequent relapses into dangerous distempers, and of various distressing pains, various distempers, which made him believe that he was often near to death. Later, he was unable to travel due to the continuance of my painful infirmities and the increase of my weaknesses. It's a typical Puritan account of how his body was wasting away. In 1672, Owen also felt burdened by opposition in various forms. And so he wrote to a friend saying, "I suppose there is scarce anyone alive in the world who has had more reproaches cast upon him than I have, including virulent revilings and false accusations." He asked his friends to pray for him. He said, "I do acknowledge unto you that in this context I have a dry and barren spirit." In defending him, the nonconformist minister John Humphrey claimed that there was a generation of men ready to fly upon anything that Owen wrote, whether it was polemical or not. Alongside all these things, there must have also been an inward pain for Owen of seeing all his ambitions for England chastened in the light of its near apostasy, from his perspective, in those restoration years. He thanked King Charles II, for his declaration of indulgence and tolerance towards the dissenters in 1672. But it was not long before Owen was up to see the king again and to complain to him about the treatment of nonconformists. The grandeur of Owen's vision of a godly republic was gone, to be replaced by more remote hopes concerning the destruction of Antichrist, the peace of the church, and the conversion of the Jews, which he longed and hoped for. Millennial hopes that he had, intense and urgent, during the period of the interregnum and the Commonwealth, were somewhat dashed by the restoration of the monarchy. And as we all know, hope deferred makes the heart sick, as the Proverbs tell us. The godly, he said, should wait quietly and patiently for what will be the end of God's judgments upon us, he said, near the end of his life. So you see, all these different experiences that Owen was going through, political defeat, ecclesiastical isolation, personal loss, intense opposition, must have taken their toll on Owen's peace of mind, don't you think? Particularly as he was meditating on the book of Hebrews in preparation for writing his gigantic commentary upon it. His mental state may actually be reflected in that commentary on scripture itself, expounding about the tears of Christ in Hebrews chapter 5 verse 7. We get an extraordinarily rare glimpse of Owen's inner world. He doesn't really publish anything about himself. He never talks about himself in his published writing, only in a few private letters. But here's one case that I found in that commentary where he talks about himself momentarily. He says, talking about the tears of Christ, he says, "Let us not then think strange if we have our season of weakness and infirmity in this world, whereby we are exposed under temptation and suffering. All these things are apt to make us faint, to despond, to be weary. I know not how others bear up their hearts and spirits. For my part, I have much ado to keep from continual longing after the embraces of the dust and shades of the grave as a curtain drawn over the rest in another world. In the meantime, every momentary gourd that interposeth between the vehemency of wind and sun, or our frail fainting natures and spirits, is too much valued by us." Around the same sort of time, he wrote to Charles Fleetwood, who had been one of the major generals in Cromwell's army. He said, "I begin to fear that we shall die in the wilderness." Christopher Hill, a great historian of this period, asserts that Owen's logical and consistent Calvinism meant that he was able to face reverses stoically. Yet to my mind, that perhaps betrays Christopher Hill's own logic more than a sober assessment of Owen's true feelings. Owen was described by one observer as valetudinarius and crazy, often down in 1677. His mood may, as another historian, Richard Greaves, suggests, his mood may have been triggered by his dismay at the perceived spread of Arminianism and Socinianism, something which often gets me down, I don't know about you. But as we've seen, that was only one of many things affecting Owen's physical and mental health at this period. By 1682, these led him to say, "My heart is done with this world, even in the best and most desirable of its refreshments." Considering the storms of controversy swirling around his head and the discomforting persecution and ill health that he had to face, it's hardly surprising that he longed for some measure of relief in death. He was not without a hope of heaven, of course, in all of this. "I am going to him whom my soul has loved, or rather, who has loved me with an everlasting love, which is the whole ground of my consolation," he wrote to Fleetwood just 2 days before he died. Yet, you know, that is the response of faith in the face of death, rather than old-fashioned stiff upper lip stoicism in the face of worldly reverses. Now, I lay out all of these kind of personal and private details of Owen's life in order to put his great intellectual endeavours into some kind of personal focus. He'd struggled with depression and despondency all through his life. Archbishop William Laud brought Owen's earthly ambitions in Oxford to an abrupt end in 1637, it seemed. And after that happened, he hardly spoke at all for 3 whole months. Can you imagine? That's just how bad it felt to have had to leave Oxford early. Perhaps he learned at that point how to cope with melancholy, since it was not so disabling later on in his life as to prevent him working diligently and laboriously on several very complex projects. He was deeply involved in many attempts to secure some kind of religious toleration for dissenters after 1662. Alongside regular preaching and teaching, he produced no fewer than 30 published works in the last 15 years of his life, including books on toleration, his monumental multi-volume work on the Holy Spirit, and yes, those large folio volumes of commentary on the book of Hebrews. All of this, I think, may have functioned as some kind of distraction for him in his season of weakness and infirmity in the world, as he put it. This Protestant work ethic certainly seems to have played an important part in his makeup. He certainly considered those who were industrious in their affairs to be far more amiable and admirable and desirable than the idle rich. "Industry in men's callings," he wrote, "is a thing in itself highly commendable. If in nothing else, it hath an advantage herein, that it is a means to preserve men from those excesses of lust and riot which otherwise they are apt to run into." I'm sure he saw many riots here in Fordham. Seems like that kind of place. Strenuous intellectual endeavours and exertions may therefore distract the mind and prevent a plunge into darkness and a melancholic longing after the shades of the grave. That then is just a brief sketch of the remarkable life of John Owen, former rector of the parish. But what did this great former rector of the parish believe in? And what was his contribution to the intellectual life and times of England? Now, before I get into this second half of what I want to say this evening, please do remember that Owen was a mere mortal. I do not at all in any way here mean to indulge in a crass hagiography about the man. He was imperfect. Oh, yes. He was sinful. He was not always consistent or clear. Or write on the things that he wrote about or did. He was prone to petulance, anger at times, and to twisting the rules in administrative affairs. I myself, I have to tell you, do not personally follow him in all of his theological, historical, and political opinions. I don't think that Joseph of Arimathea first brought the gospel to England, by the way, as he did. Just one of those things on which I would disagree with him. However, all that being said, what I'd like to say about Owen is this. Firstly, Owen was a Christian statesman. Christian statesman. Indeed, Peter Toon's great 1972 biography of Owen is called God's Statesman. And he earns this title especially by virtue of his relationship to Oliver Cromwell, the Lord Protector. As John Milton wrote of that great leader, "Cromwell, our chief of men, who through a cloud, not of war only, but detractions rude, guided by faith and matchless fortitude, to peace and truth thy glorious way has ploughed." Well, Owen sat with our chief of men. And where Milton says he was guided by faith, that sometimes meant in practice that he was guided by Owen. Siding with Parliament in the civil wars meant Owen was actually cut off by the rich uncle who had paid for his university education, and he was a royalist. So he cut Owen off and stopped his money. But that was the making of Owen politically, and it brought him into contact with a wide range of powerful patrons in the army and in Parliament. He built up a network of patronage and contacts with the deliberate purpose of bringing about godly religious reform in England and freedom of conscience. The young, ambitious theologian became the preacher-in-chief to the Council of State, the cabinet, you may say, of the day. And he even went with the great general to Scotland and to Ireland on Cromwell's fateful campaigns to bring the Celtic fringe to heel. Owen was certainly a player, though not always a successful one, I have to say, and perhaps, yes, something of a bully, even deceitful at times, in the way he tried to reform things in Oxford University when he was the vice-chancellor. But he acted out of principle, so much so that when his principles collided with Cromwell's principles, Owen became estranged from the chief, even though that did him no favours politically. It is said that Owen played some role in the downfall of Richard Cromwell, Oliver's son. And his political acumen, I think, can be seen in the surprising fact that he escaped any personal, serious repercussions at the hands of Charles II after the Restoration. Indeed, Owen became the go-to nonconformist in many ways, alongside Richard Baxter, with whom he did not get on at all. And he was mostly successful at evading the evil Conventicles Act. So Owen was a Christian statesman. Don't worry, this is not a Puritan sermon. There aren't 17 points. That's the first one. Secondly, he was a Calvinist, wasn't he? So there must be 5 points tonight. If you've already thought ahead, you'll see that. Secondly, Owen was a fine scholar. A fine scholar. Owen knew his classics, for example. In one of his books from 1669, during which he's complaining at that period, you know, of not being allowed into the Bodleian Library because he's a nonconformist, they won't let him get access to the books. He still, in one of his books from that year, I looked through it, I found allusions and quotations from Aristotle, Alexander the Great, Plautus, Juvenal, Horace, Xenophon, Plutarch, Virgil, Plato, Aristophanes, Lucian, Homer, Cicero, Ovid, Perseus, Papinius, Catullus, Julius Caesar, Lucretius. Hands up if you've even read all of those people or heard of all of those people. And yet, from a survey of Owen's other works, it is clear that he had a first-hand knowledge of this canon of ancient literature and philosophy in the original languages, and he could call it to mind and employ it with good effect. His Greek, his Hebrew, his Latin were all very much up to scratch. Indeed, in his commentary on the book of Hebrews, Owen took great pains to interact with the Jewish background material to the book of Hebrews, quoting from medieval rabbis, Maimonides, Kimchi, from Josephus, Philo, the Talmuds, the Mishnah, the Targums, and other Jewish writings. He could cite from Rabbi Levi, Rabbi Yodan, Rabbi Berechiah, Elias Leviter, Moses Gerundensis, and many, many others. Some of his Jewish sources are quoted from Latin translations, but many others he just gives you the unpointed Aramaic or Hebrew, followed sometimes by his own English translation of that text. He shows awareness of the historical context of his Jewish sources and how this might affect their usefulness. He clearly appears to have been working from the best primary texts of Judaica available in his day. And it colours his exegesis of the Epistle to the Hebrews. He was at the cutting edge of the scholarly application of Hebraic studies to the understanding of the New Testament in the 17th century. And he was seen as an authority on this matter and on other matters like it, on all sides of the ecclesiastical divide. At the end of the 17th century, Anthony A. Wood, there's some Woods amongst us tonight, I think, Anthony A. Wood, who may be one of your esteemed predecessors, compiles a well-known encyclopedic biographical history of all the people he could get material on from the University of Oxford. In that work, Athenae Oxoniensis, he has a little biography of Owen. And he's far from complimentary about the great vice-chancellor, pointing out what he considered Owen's many failings and inconsistencies during the 1640s and the 1650s and the 1660s. He quotes other people who give their opinions about Dr. Owen, all rather negative. But then Wood adds a very personal note, saying, "But what I myself knew of Owen, which may, I hope, be mentioned without offence or envy or flattery, is, let rash or giddy heads say whatever they please, that he was actually a person well skilled in the tongues, in rabbinical learning, in Jewish rites and customs. So whatever people thought of his churchmanship or his politics, he earned the respect of the academy for his deep stores of learning." And even though his English reads like the roughly dashed off translation of a piece of thinking done in Ciceronian Latin, as Professor Packer once put it, one of the most admirable things about Owen's corpus is that the vast majority of everything he wrote was published in English. Competent though he was in the language of the lecture hall and the international scholarly guild of the day, Latin, he chose not to present his theology, as most theologians did, in that alien tongue, but instead to write in a language that would be understood by the people. Now, this was probably a function of his third characteristic, to which I'd like to draw your attention, which is that he was a thoroughgoing Protestant. So thirdly, Owen was a thoroughgoing Protestant. If you're one of those people who sort of nods off during the middle of the sermon, here's the point to just nudge the person next to you, make sure they're awake. Here's the third point. Owen was not only a Christian statesman and a fine scholar, but also, thirdly, a thoroughgoing Protestant. Even, we might say, I'm going to be slightly cheeky tonight, and say that we might say he was a firm Anglican who loved the Reformation settlement of the Church of England. The Reverend John Owen, after all, let us not forget, was an ordained Anglican minister, serving for many years as the vicar of this parish, and then at Cogshall down the road, before becoming Dean of the Cathedral Church of Christ in Oxford. Now, we may characterise him as a Puritan, and he was not a fan of some aspects of the church's governance and ceremonies, but doctrinally, he was entirely in accord with the confessional stance and basis of Anglicanism. even when he was ejected from the national church by that iniquitous act of uniformity in 1662, he was happy to say, "I embrace the doctrine of the Church of England, as declared in the 39 Articles and other approved public writings of the most famous bishops and other divines thereof." That's a rather tighter subscription formula than we expect of current vicars, isn't it? I mean, if we could get half the members of General Synod to say that sort of thing, we'd be happy, wouldn't we, Mary? Indeed, he writes in 1669, "The chief glory of the English Reformation consisted in the purity of its doctrine, then first restored to the nation. This, as it was expressed in the Articles of Religion, in the publicly authorized writings of the bishops and chief divines of the Church of England, is, as I've said, the glory of the English Reformation." Let's remember that as we celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation next year. So what is it? What was this confessional doctrine to which John Owen adhered so enthusiastically? He affirms that on the subject of justification by faith alone and the imputation of the righteousness of Christ, that he was entirely on the side of the Church of England's authentic writings in the Articles, in the books of homilies, and that sort of thing. In his book on justification, which expounds and defends the comfortable doctrine of justification by faith alone, he says, "I shall not in the least depart from the ancient doctrine of the Church of England. I have no design but to declare and vindicate it, as God shall enable." And so he concludes, "It is faith alone which from the beginning of the world has been the means and way of obtaining acceptance with God." Faith alone, not faith and our good works or anything else, but faith alone has always been the way of being accepted by God. He was also as opposed to Roman Catholic errors as any other Protestant of the 16th and 17th centuries. He held firmly to classic Protestant doctrines like justification sola fide, salvation by grace alone, through Christ alone, as revealed in Scripture alone, and all for the glory of God alone. What's more, he was more than able of carrying on a lively and informed debate with Roman Catholic interpreters and theologians while exposing what he considered their perfidious false teachings. He was implacably opposed to antichrists in Rome and to his religion, believing the Church of Rome to have committed heresy, schism, apostasy, and idolatry. As for the outward aesthetic of some people, in worship, he said, their paintings, their crossings, their crucifixes, bowings, cringings, altars, tapers, wafers, organs, anthems, litany, rails, images, copes, vestments, what are they but a Roman varnish, an Italian dress for our devotion, which draw us to conform with that enemy of the Lord Jesus, the Antichrist. Well, whatever you think of that, in terms of his church polity, Owen initially flirted with Presbyterianism before becoming eventually committed to the more congregational way. Yet along with other independents of the 17th century, Owen did not believe in the separation of church and state, as many hold to that modern American tenet today. Indeed, Owen thought that the state had a duty to stop anti-Trinitarians from infiltrating the church, for example. The state had a duty to silence those who did not teach justification by faith alone. The magistrates should enforce that view in his opinion. Indeed, he says, it is against the light and law of nature for the supreme magistrate not to exert its authority to support, preserve, and further the cause of the gospel. And it should forbid, coerce, and restrain false teaching. Owen, however, had little time for those who remained Anglican in form, but not in doctrine. Remember, he wasn't Anglican in his churchmanship, but he did believe in Anglican doctrine in the 39 Articles. But there are many who stayed Anglican in the system, but who were not Anglican in their actual teaching. There were many of those in the 17th century who attacked the nonconformists, who were perfectly sound on their basic Protestant doctrine, but who left all manner of heretics alone as long as they obeyed the outward rules. So as long as you wear the right thing in church and bow whenever you're supposed to, doesn't matter what you believe, doesn't matter what kind of heresy you teach, as long as you wear the right thing. In his first published book, which must have been really good because it got him this parish, he gives some instances of people who opposed the received doctrine of the Church of England contained in the 39 Articles. He said, "We are living in iniquitous times, because had a poor Puritan offended against half so many canons as they have opposed articles, he would have forfeited his livelihood, if not endangered his life." See, it was acceptable to many to oppose the doctrine of the articles of religion, but not to break the minutiae of canon law. Indeed, even many senior church leaders were so zealous for the discipline and yet so negligent of the doctrine of the Church of England. Owen thought that was a scandal because he was deeply attached to the Protestant doctrine of the Church of England. My heart strangely warmed by that. I don't know about yours. Fourthly, though, we can go further about Owen's theology and say that he was not just a thoroughgoing Protestant, but he was also a solidly Reformed theologian, with a capital R, a Reformed theologian. Now, Owen was not a mere Englishman of the 17th century. Intellectually, he fully inhabited 1,600 years of Christian theological discussions and saw himself as a part of the international community of Reformed churches in Western Christendom. He says, "I own no religion, no article of faith, but what is taught expressly in Scripture, mostly confirmed by the ancient general councils of the primitive church and the writings of the most learned fathers, especially those against all sorts of heretics like the Gnostics, the Photinians, and the Pelagians, consonant with the articles of religion of the Church of England and the doctrine of all the Reformed churches of Europe." You see, Owen feels himself to be part of something so much bigger than just this one church or just this one denomination. He felt himself to be in harmony with the Reformed churches from places like the Netherlands, Heidelberg, Strasbourg, Zurich, and Geneva. Reformed, with a capital R, is sometimes used as a synonym for Calvinist. But the eponymous Frenchman was only one of a number of significant voices in the international Reformed community, and by no means the decisive one at this point. Peter Martyr Vermeely's Commonplaces, Heinrich Bullinger's Decades, are less well known today than Calvin's Institutes, but they were popular and authoritative bestsellers, believe it or not, in Reformation and post-Reformation England. Now, Owen refers to these people, Martin Bucer, John Calvin, Peter Martyr, Theodore Beza, as the principal and most eminent of Bible commentators, and he thanks God for their great and holy works. He feels himself part of that tradition. What did it mean at this point to be specifically Reformed in that context? Well, as you may know, the Reformation movement away from Rome split in two during the 1540s into the Lutheran and the Reformed streams of Protestantism. The dividing line was ostensibly to do with the Lord's Supper. What did it mean when Christ said, "This is my body"? Now, granted, all Protestants rejected the Roman theory of transubstantiation. The bread and the wine remained in substance after the prayer of consecration, as far as Protestants are concerned. It's still bread. It's still wine. Whereas the Roman Church taught that it was no longer wine, no longer bread and no longer wine, but really, physically, the body and blood of Christ. That being said, though, that it hadn't changed into Jesus, was Jesus' physical human nature somehow present in, with, under the bread and the wine somehow? Luther insisted that it was, which led to the Lutheran idea of the ubiquity of Christ's human nature, that somehow, through the communication of attributes from his divine nature, Christ is physically present everywhere at the same time. And so in that way, he can be present in the Lord's Supper, in your church, in my church, in every church, physically present. On the other side, the Reformed, beginning with people like Zwingli, who's a great one to have, the Scrabble, if you're allowed to use those sort of names. Zwingli, at the colloquy, there's another one, at the colloquy of Marburg in 1529, they dissented from Luther's view. They weren't Catholics, they were Protestants, but they dissented from Luther's view of this subject. They did so for Christological reasons. Christ's physical human nature, they said, is in one specific place. Where is Jesus? He is seated at the right hand of the Father until he comes again in glory to judge the living and the dead. Indeed, if Christ's physical human nature can be present everywhere, or even in two places at once, then it's not a human nature like ours. Anybody here able to bilocate? Can you be in two places at once? Be very useful, wouldn't it? I said this to someone recently and they said, oh yes, I can tag myself in two different places on Facebook at the same time. I'll give you that, but I don't think it counts. So if Jesus can be physically in two different places at the same time, according to his human nature, then he doesn't have a human nature like mine. And that is a problem, isn't it? Because if he doesn't possess a human nature like ours, then he cannot be our representative and our substitute on the cross. So you see, what looked like an argument about some of the words in the communion liturgy became an argument about the person of Christ and about salvation. Sacramentology was profoundly connected to Christology and soteriology, to use the buzzwords. And so as these two Lutheran and Reformed branches of Protestantism diverged, they drew up for themselves confessions of faith to express and promote and propagate their different views, just as other groups did as well. The Augsburg Confession for the Lutherans, the Heidelberg Catechism and the Belgic Confession for the Reformed, at the Council of Trent for the Catholics. Now, when certain people began to be discontent with those statements, an ecumenical gathering of all the Reformed churches was called in 1618 to address that challenge from within. That gathering met in a Dutch town called Dordrecht, also known as Dort, and it comprised the cream of Dutch Reformed theologians, representatives from England, Scotland, Wales, from several German city-states, and separate delegations representing Geneva and other Swiss cities. This represented what Owen says was esteemed of the best of all the Reformed churches of Europe that they could afford at that time. Now, the importance of that international gathering of first-class Reformed theologians, we can hardly underestimate the significance of that, because it is there that the so-called 5 points of Calvinism was first carefully defined, in opposition to the more progressive and liberal tenets of their Arminian opponents. The Synod of Dort spoke authoritatively on the doctrines of sin, predestination, atonement, grace, and perseverance. Now, those things are not everything there is to say about Reformed theology, of course. There's no mention particularly there of the Reformation solas, the Trinity, or the sacraments per se in all of the things said at Dort, although they are clearly part of the Reformed faith. Later gatherings of Reformed theologians would build on the narrowly soteriological concerns of Dort in more rounded statements of doctrine. The Westminster Confession and catechisms are a notable example from Owen's day. Now, Owen was not a member of the famous Westminster Assembly, but he did later help to draw up a similar confession of faith for the FIEC, independent churches, called the Savoy Declaration, or a declaration of the faith and order owned and practiced in the Congregational Churches of England, 1658. So you've got to have a long title. You can't just call it Savoy Declaration. You know, you've got to have at least 20 words in the title, because that's what they did. Now, this confession of faith that Owen helped to draw up had some eccentricities of its own, as you might expect. But Owen said that when you compare what we have written to all the other Reformed confessions, you will see that in all material points, it is the same with them. See, Owen is part of the Reformed tradition across the world. However, he has also been accused of being a Reformed scholastic. That final word there being pronounced with a decidedly derisory sneer. A scholastic. J.B. Rogers and Donald McKim, for example, have proposed an influential thesis that Reformed scholasticism interprets scripture as a non-historical body of propositions that offer a base of inerrant information on which to construct a universal philosophy. Rational, deductive arguments, inappropriate Aristotelianism, and a dictation theory of inspiration are meant to characterize this movement. So say Rogers and McKim. It departs significantly from the real Reformation stance of Luther and Calvin. Luther and Calvin good, Reformed scholastics bad. This lively gospel message of the early reformers was supposedly replaced by a gospel-obscuring scholastic dead letter. The personal replaced by the propositional, the dynamic by the static. And thus began the disintegration, we're told, whereby dogmaticians supposedly extract timeless principles from a flattened out Bible. But this characterization is one of the now discarded waste products of the discredited Calvin against the Calvinist school of thought. Because Reformed scholasticism was nothing of the sort in reality. It was not about rigidifying scripture in a doctrine of inerrancy, Hebrew vowel points and all, or baptizing Aristotle, the pagan philosopher. No, Protestants who had rejected transubstantiation as an unbiblical Aristotelian innovation would be very wary about reconnecting with a discredited philosopher without serious qualification. Their scholasticism, if you want to call it that, was first and foremost a method, not a set of conclusions at all, just a method adopted to ensure the institutionalization of the Reformation's basic core doctrines. See, they needed to be carefully formulated, codified, and passed on in schools, hence scholastic. They need to be passed on to the next generation if they are to survive unscathed against increasingly sophisticated counter-arguments. Basically, one has to defend against false teaching with a comparable level of academic sophistication. To put it bluntly, if your opponent comes against you with a sword, you may defeat them by being a good swordsman. If they come against you with a spear, you may win by getting a shield. But if they come against you with a tank, you have to upgrade your defences if you are going to defend your position. And Owen was absolutely convinced that the first generation Reformation truth that he had been taught as a child was more than capable of being defended at the very deepest, most complex levels of exegesis, theology, and philosophy. Reformed scholasticism, then, is just Reformed theology, Reformation theology, in an academic gown. Although, ironically, Owen did actually try and get rid of academic gowns when he was in charge of Oxford University. But Reformation scholasticism is Reformation theology in academic gown, just opposing, fighting its corner against its most serious rivals, using the best and most up-to-date tools at its disposal. Now, as a theologian, Owen is more of an academic institutionaliser then, rather than a pioneer like Luther. But that's not something to be ashamed of, is it? I don't think it's something to be ashamed of. Rather, we ought to celebrate the fact that this man's impressive scholastic gifts were placed at the disposal of the Protestant Reformed faith. The faith which he cherished is always in need of stout and loyal defenders, willing to go to the trouble of intricately refuting the errors of false interpreters in a dangerous world where the devil and the Antichrist are constantly trying to undermine the faith of God's elect. Well, with that in mind, is there anything else we can say about John Owen? I promised you 5 points, didn't I? Appropriately. So what have we had so far? It's important to add that he was not only a Christian statesman, a fine scholar, a thoroughgoing Protestant, and a solidly Reformed theologian. He was also, finally, a prodigious Bible commentator. A Bible commentator. Now, intellectual historians have only recently begun seriously to appropriate biblical interpretation to fill out their picture of significant figures and movements in history. Amongst those who specialise in the works of Thomas Aquinas, for example, 13th century theologian, it's only recently that scholars have begun to insist on the importance of studying Aquinas' biblical commentaries to fill out their picture of the man. Aquinas wrote 10 biblical detailed commentaries on the Bible. And yet the relative neglect of them may be understandable when we discover that they were considered by many to be too advanced for his contemporaries. Now, let me tell you that there has been very little sustained scholarly attention given to the history of biblical exegesis in the 17th century. And if historians have been very wary of touching Aquinas' commentaries, which are easy, let me tell you that opening the pages of John Owen's mammoth and magisterial commentary on Hebrews might well leave some in need of smelling salts. Because extravagant praise has been heaped on his multi-volume commentary. At just under 2 million words in length, just get that for a moment, it is more than twice as long as the whole Bible. At just under 2 million words in length. This work is extraordinary, said one 18th century critic, rich testimony to the remarkable learning and diligence of the author. Another writer says, every sentence of it is precious, which is quite something, because there's a lot of sentences in 2 million words. Perhaps not as many Owenian sentences as others of us would write, because he does tend to go on with his sentences. But there we are. It is a work of gigantic strength, as well as gigantic size. Anyone who has mastered it is very little short, says one critic, very little short, both in respect to the doctrinal and practical of Christianity, of being an erudite and accomplished theologian. In the mid-19th century, one biography of Owen by Andrew Thompson complains of the appalling magnitude of his commentary on Hebrews, comparing it to a vast medieval cathedral, whose stable walls and noble columns astonish you at the skill and strength of the builder the longer you gaze. Typical over-the-top 19th century rhetoric, but there we are. Nobody, says Andrew Thompson, had sat down to study and expound Hebrews without consulting this book for 150 years. You've got to be careful where you put the comma there, haven't you? Had they been consulting Owen's commentary for 150 years, would it take that long to read it? Yes, it might. In the 20th century, Jim Packer also praises the sheer scale of Owen's commentary on Hebrews, saying, "Nothing to match Owen's achievement was done before him, nor has been done since his day." Owen himself said, "Adoro plenitudinem scripturarum." I adore, I reverence, I love the fullness of the scriptures. And so in his commentary, he seeks to unwrap as much of the message of Hebrews as he was able. His exposition is in English, but based on the original Greek and interacting with many other commentators, liberally peppered with Latin and Greek and Hebrew and Aramaic, but not so obsessed with the minutiae that it neglects doctrinal and practical application. None of the other commentaries available in English at the time had the depth, breadth, or the audacious size and scope of Owen's work. Believe me, I've read the others. None of them match what Owen was doing. It would not be an exaggeration to suggest that a shelf full of the best contemporary critical and devotional commentaries in Latin and in English would be required to match what Owen was doing in his commentary. Its detailed and sustained interaction with one set of interlocutors in particular, Hugo Grotius and the rationalistic anti-Trinitarians known as the Socinians, demonstrates a close attention to scriptural detail in order to refute the exegetical underpinnings of contemporary heterodoxy. His use of Hebraic sources, as I've already mentioned, was extensive and innovative. It was the first, and perhaps still the most impressive, full-scale attempt to incorporate the use of Jewish learning into an exposition of Hebrews since the flowering of that scholarship during the Renaissance. His attention to detail, textual detail, in remapping a biblical theology of the covenants, one of the most contentious intra-reformed debates of his day, is striking, particularly given the way that it puts him at odds with the majority of reformed theologians. And his interaction with Roman Catholic interpretation demonstrates the clear primacy of the exegetical over the polemical in his work, notwithstanding the very tense anti-papal atmosphere in which he worked. But think about it this way instead. What does it say about Owen the man? That in such a disturbed and potentially depressing stage of his career, which we've already talked about, that at that stage of his career, he kept going back to his desk to work at such a weighty project. Certainly it says to me that he'd not given up all hope or sense of calling to serve the church, despite his experience of defeat, and that he considered such long-term endeavours still worthwhile, despite what was going on in the wider church. To plan and to execute such a large project betrays no obvious sense of panic about his wilderness situation or a lack of vision, notwithstanding his occasional longing after the embraces of the dust and the shades of the grave, as a curtain drawn over the rest in another world. To produce something of such enduring value that it has never been out of print since the mid-17th century, as well as being deeply involved in many urgent short-term projects, speaks folio volumes for this man's persistence and his foresight, however you might actually assess the success or otherwise of his actual exegetical performance. Whether you agree with his interpretation of Hebrews or not, you have to feel the weight of what he has accomplished. So then, as I draw to a close, Owen was a Christian statesman, a fine scholar, a thoroughgoing Protestant, a solidly reformed theologian, and a prodigious Bible commentator. There's much else that we could say about this man who stares down at us this evening from the wall behind me. His preaching, his pastoring, his Trinitarianism. We'll hear a bit more about that tomorrow morning, I think, in church. His church politics, his pleas for toleration, his eschatology, a bit weird there, and his readings of divine providence in the events of his day. All of these would repay careful study. But time is against me this evening. What is Owen's legacy for us today? Well, he's not particularly honoured back at Christ Church in Oxford. As far as I could tell, when I last visited the cathedral there, they're not particularly proud of Dr. Owen. His works in 24 volumes, small print, fat volumes, remain in print today. We could actually do with a new scholarly edition of those volumes, because what we've got is an old 19th century edition that someone's just reprinted. And there's actually been something of a resurgence of interest in Owen over the last 20 or 30 years. And so we could do with updating the scholarship in a critical edition. He is certainly one of the most significant and prolific theologians that England has ever produced. But was he, as some have said, the Calvin of England? That's a rather weighty title, isn't it? Was he the Calvin of England? No, he was not, in my opinion. He was not the equivalent of John Calvin in the sense of being our greatest reformer. The first generation of the Reformation gave us Thomas Cranmer, for example, who has perhaps the most defensible claim to that title. Owen was not born until a century after Luther nailed the 95 Theses to that door in Wittenberg. He was part of a movement to solidify, defend, and promote Reformed theology against a retrenched and somewhat revitalized Roman Catholicism, a resurgent rationalistic liberalism in the form of the Socinians, and a renegade spiritualism in the form of the Quakers and others who separated word from spirit. He played the part assigned to him by divine providence with skill and with verve. So in the roll call of prolific, deep-thinking, influential theologians, Owen does rank very highly indeed as a theologian, Bible commentator, a statesman, and a pastor. He certainly deserves to be considered one of our top men. So when the French boast of Calvin, we can, with some justification and with heads held high, boast in some way of the former vicar of this parish. But perhaps we should do that in a typically English sort of way, with a slight air of superiority. For we know that Owen is something of an acquired taste, like the cheese and the wine we have on the tables tonight. And not many people will fully appreciate it or understand it fully. But I hope and I pray that his reputation and that of the Reformed faith which he so diligently served will be kept alive for many years to come in this place. Thank you.
Lee, thank you very much. You've held us rapt attention for well over an hour. We're going to have a little break now, so have more cheese and wine. There's tea and coffee being served at the Hatch, so do go and get some tea and coffee. In about 5 minutes, we'll have some questions for you. So do talk amongst yourselves as to what questions you might like to ask, and then we'll have a period of about a quarter of an hour of questions before we say a final thank you to you. Great. Thank you.